Welcome to Film Studies Bling Bling, a podcast dedicated to the big and small treasures of film studies. This is the 10th episode, an anniversary. In this episode, I'm very happy to introduce Raya Morak as my Bling of the Month. The news chapter is about the Yumhis Challenge. The winners were chosen. One of the winners is Astrid Corporal. We will hear from her what kind of project she will realize with the help of the prize money and the support of the Yumhist. In the Dear Diary, I will tell you about my current theoretical work on my research project. Discourse is the key word here. It's nice to have you with me. By the way, if you would like to use this podcast to promote a symposium, to announce a new research group, or to promote and publicize topics you find important, just write to me. a.kiss@filmuniversität.de. I'm very happy to make this forum available for you. Here's my Bling of the Month, Raya Morak. Welcome to my podcast, Raya.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Raya Morak is an associate professor of cinema studies at the Department of Communication and Journalism at the Hebrew University. Once again, I find myself with the difficulty of having to summarize an outstanding and rich academic life. At the very minimum, one could cite your wide-ranging research in numerous publications dealing with documentary cinema, New German cinema, Vietnam War films, Israeli and Palestinian Second Intifada cinema, New Cambodian cinema, and corporate feminist film critique. And I would describe the interaction of film and trauma studies as a key feature of your work. In this context, you have enriched research with works on cinema, war and masculinity, post-traumatic cinema, and perpetrator cinema. For perpetrator trauma and perpetrator cinema, you have done some basic definitional work. Maybe we'll start with that. How do you conceptualize perpetrator trauma cinema and perpetrator cinema, Raya?
First, I would like to set the background and then differentiate between these two terms, perpetrator trauma and perpetrator cinema. I began my work on trauma and cinema by defining post-traumatic cinema in the context of war. I asked how German films on World War II and the new German cinema and American films on the Vietnam War present the trauma of defeat in war. So taking into consideration the major differences between the two wars and the two contexts and the two industries, I found many shared characteristics. Among them, I can point the repression of the trauma of defeat, the broken, deprived of the gaze and non-sexual masculinity, and post-war masculinity moved to the margins of the symbolic order or outside it. And both corpora put forth an ethical dimension. The construction of masculinity and manliness, I would say, in both carries the ideological statements of these cultures in relation to their traumatic past. For example, New German cinema's presentation of defeated masculinity undoubtedly bears the corpus negation of fascist Nazi masculinity, even though they relate mostly to family melodramas and not war movies. So through defeated masculinity, we can see that post-war directors opposed the Nazi regime, although the Holocaust was rarely presented in their films. So my conceptualization of perpetrator trauma was driven by a new wave of Israeli documentary cinema that emerged in the post-Second Intifada period. Intifada is the Palestinian uprising. And I can mention, for instance, maybe the most known film is Ari Folman's What's with Bashir, but maybe people also know Tamar Yaron's To See If I Am Smiling and Avi Mograbi's Z32, all from 2007 and 2008. And this new wave broached the topic of violent acts carried out by Israeli soldiers during the Second Intifada and violation of human rights. And in this regard, it has undoubtedly, I think, pioneered the representation of the trauma of 21st century perpetrator in world cinema. It appeared before American documentary cinema on Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and U.S. involvement in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. So if you would like, I can say a few words on the concept of perpetrator trauma.
That would be brilliant, yeah.
Perpetrator trauma is a concept emanated from this new wave of Israeli film. It is a theoretical concept I developed to describe the ethical trauma suffered by soldiers who in the new postmodern war confront civilians. They find themselves in what the Harvard psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton calls an atrocity-producing situation. This is his term. The concept of perpetrator trauma as ethical trauma stands in direct contrast to the more traditional and pervasive theorization of victim trauma, which I regard as a psychological trauma.
In your current research, you focus on the perpetrator figure and trauma in cinema, with a particular emphasis on new Cambodian cinema. Just published is your book, Perpetrator Cinema, Confronting Genocide in Cambodian Documentary. I would say that we can only talk about the current book if we first talk about at least one previous publication of yours, because you mentioned already Waltzing with Bashir. So let's talk about your book, Waltzing with Bashir, Perpetrator Trauma and Cinema. Here you suggest a shift in psychological and psychiatric trauma discourse since Freud. Tell us about the film you selected, Waltzing with Bashir, to investigate this focus shift and why your body of films was so well suited to analyzing perpetrator traumas in cinema.
Well, I argue in that book that trauma research fails to offer the tools necessary to cope with a post-traumatic perpetrator. Canonical psychological and psychiatric trauma research from Freud's Etiology of Hysteria, that is 1896, to the present has traditionally and rightly been carried out from the perspective of identification with the victim. So have cinema trauma research and contemporary humanities-based trauma studies, climaxing during the 1990s in widespread interest in the victim and in testimony, vis-a-vis the Holocaust, war, and domestic violence, as we all know. The novel concept of perpetrator trauma breaks over 100 years of repression of the abhorrent and rejected concept of the perpetrator in research, which generally perceives perpetrator trauma as unseemly and unthinkable. So proposing a new direction in cinema studies dealing with national traumas, which is for the first time recognizes this shift from trauma suffered by victims to that of perpetrator, requires, I think, a new epistemology. It requires its readers break deep-seated psychological and psychiatric as well as cultural and political repression. Maybe I shall put it in more personal terms. I am an Israeli leftist scholar. Mm-hmm. Okay, as an Israeli leftist scholar caught in the trap of being symbolically and practically part of a regime of an occupation I detest, it is my aim to define the horizon of this new epistemology in order to pave the way for acknowledgement of perpetration deeds carried out in my name in the occupied territories. So I hope this conceptualization of perpetrator trauma contributes to understanding Israeli culture, which must balance between the Holocaust and the occupation, simultaneously experience victim and perpetrator traumas. But it also contributes to understanding American cinema on Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, as I mentioned earlier, and current trauma theory at large.
In your current book, Perpetrator Cinema, you examine the genocide carried out by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, in which from 1975 to 1979, 2 million Cambodians died. What prompted you to deal with this traumatic event in your academic work?
Well, more than a decade ago, during an international film festival, I watched a Cambodian documentary film, S21. S21, the Khmer Rouge Death Machine. This is the film title. And this film presents the interaction between two survivors of the notorious execution center in Phnom Penh and their former Khmer Rouge torturers and guards. It is mediated by the camera of the French-Cambodian director Rithi Pan, himself a survivor of the genocide. So soon after watching S21, the Khmer Rouge Death Machine, I became, how would I put it, maybe I should say terrifically amazed by Rithi Pan's entire oeuvre. I later learned that during the Pol Pot auto-genocidal regime, a greater proportion of the population perished than in any other 20th century revolution. and that the entire strata of the middle and intellectual classes, including the directors, actors, actresses, novelists, technicians, cameramen, everywhere, were murdered and the cinema industry demolished. So this background made me both more appreciative of and more puzzled over the extraordinary renaissance of the new Cambodian filmmaking, which I believe to be a rare phenomenon in world cinema. And of course, the case of autogenocide calls for interpretation of the perpetrator position, a subject I came to learn about through years of research.
In your recent book, you explore a shift related to the general shift in the depiction of trauma, what you call in your introduction the recent social, cultural, psychological shift from the era of the witness to the era of the perpetrator. Can you explain this to us, perhaps also in connection with the shift you have identified from the trauma of the victims to the trauma of the perpetrators?
The era of the perpetrator is defined not only by the traumatic calendar. We all know that 75 years have passed in the end of World War II. It is also defined by the rise of what I regard as a new 21st century phenomenon, which I call perpetrator cinema, cinema that deals with a genocidal or maybe a other mass killing event through focusing on the perpetrator figure or maybe collaborator figure as the main protagonist, the main interviewee of a documentary. So if we take post-Holocaust activism as a paradigm, although a few of the most well-known Nazi hunters were concentration camp survivors, maybe most notably Simon Wiesenthal, they were not filmmakers. The documentarists of Cambodian perpetrator cinema are driven by the hunt and the revelation of the historical truth. They rewrite this truth via their confrontation with the perpetrator. In most of their films, they are under the perpetrator's gaze and feel compelled to present their own partial or full testimonies. So this is an exceptional situation in Cambodia. And this exceptional situation is a result not only of post-genocide circumstances in which the whereabouts of high and low-ranking perpetrators are unknown because they fled and hide in rural Cambodia, but also of the filmmakers' multiple subject positions. Because the filmmakers are survivors of the Pol Pot autogenocide, as well as docu-history activists, and the perpetrators' interviewers. The image of the perpetrator is precise. It's a real-life figure confronted by the director, and mostly depicted through his defeat or upcoming defeat at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. You know, the tribunal founded in 2006 to bring high-ranking perpetrators to trial. And it exposed the historical truth after 30 or 40 years of taboo. And in this way, it assisted directors with their activism. So I call this documentary dueling. It is an extraordinary format in which the survivors are described, interviews, and confronts the perpetrator. And it offers new conceptions regarding the major questions that still haunt post-Holocaust research and practice that have become part of the legacy of the 20th century. In my book, I say or I contend that during the second half of the 20th century, the genocide studies and related field of research were overwhelmed by the indecipherability of the Holocaust and continuing difficulties in bringing Nazis to trial. They therefore produced one of the major enigmas of the 20th century, that of the ordinary perpetrator. But based on lengthy interactions, Cambodian perpetrator cinema poses new questions, such as whether this documentary dueling will civilize the perpetrator.
For your recent book, you have once more put together a highly interesting film corpus. Please describe your selection. What distinguishes the documentary films and how they are capable of, what you said, providing epistemic tools for the shift from the era of the witness to the era of the perpetrator?
Well, Cambodian perpetrator cinema, I think, proposes for the first time in the history of cinema, as I said, a direct, non-archival, face-to-face confrontation between the first-generation survivor and the perpetrator. This is an extraordinary encounter with both high and low ranking perpetrator. And it is enabled by the intimate horror of the autogenocidal nature of Cambodian genocide, when the Khmer Rouge murdered, as you say, a quarter of their own people. And it can occur only because of the horrific neighborhood prevalent in post-1979 rural Cambodia, where perpetrators live among their former victims and still exert power over them. So encounters with high-ranking perpetrators are revealed in films such as director survivor Thet Sambath and his British co-director Rob Lemkin's film Enemies of the People, A Personal Journey into the Heart of the Killing Fields from 2009. After a 10-year quest across rural Cambodia, Thet Sambath ultimately located Nuon Chea. Nuon Chea was the chief ideologist of the Khmer Rouge. He was prime minister of Democratic Cambodia and brother number two. That is, he was second in command only to Pol Pot. And after developing a relationship and interviewing him over the course of 3 years, Nuon Chea finally admitted to the director survivor, to Sambath, and to Lemkin, his co-director, that he had been involved in Pol Pot's decision to kill their Cambodian compatriot. In another documentary film, Dutch, Master of the Forges of Hell, from 2011, director survivor Rithi Pan, whom I mentioned before, presents a dueling dynamic based on refuting the perpetrator lies. Hundreds of hours of interviews with Keng Wek Eve, nicknamed Dutch or Diok, who was Pol Pot's chief executioner and former commandant of the infamous detention and execution center S21, is at stake. It's not Dutch's failed or partial confirmation, but the transformation in power relations between the two of them. And we can add to that more examples. Films like Lida Chan and Gyeong Suwon, Red Wedding from 2012, and Miri Adeline Hayes, Ankar from 2018, that present confrontations with low-ranking perpetrators. I think that this new form of testimony, the duel, marks a new phase in world cinema's representation of genocide, as well as in genocide studies and other related fields of research. And if you would like, I can explain the difference between the concept of perpetrator trauma and the concept of perpetrator cinema.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah? Okay. So I think I should add that perpetrator trauma is but a part of a large 21st century phenomenon of interviewing perpetrators. But it is totally different in substance. The soldiers, the Israeli soldier or American soldiers, who confess their violation of human rights in the territories, do so voluntarily. Their confession is uncathartic. They address the Israeli government and demand recognition of the wrongdoings done to the Palestinians. This is ethical trauma, as we said, based on self-criminalizing. And it is therefore the total opposite of the perpetrator's lies and their refusal to take responsibility for their actions, which we find in other contexts. So we should not confuse these two terms. In other words, I am not interested at all in Dutch or Doik trauma, if he had experienced any, but the political movement of Israel Defense Forces veterans who call for the Israeli government to recognize the deeds carried out in the occupied territories is highly important.
Raya, there is a potential other trauma in the future. The corona pandemic might also be a traumatic experience for many in the future. Do you think there will be a post-traumatic cinema that will address this crisis or this traumatic experience? And wouldn't your criteria, the differentiations you developed and explained, will they be suited to an analysis of this post-traumatic trauma? What do you think?
Yes, I think there will be a post-traumatic cinema that addressed the corona pandemic crisis, of course. We know, for example, that after the major catastrophes of the 20th century, post-traumatic cinemas did emerge. For example, after Hiroshima, there was a huge wave of horror and science fiction films presenting all kinds of bodily mutations in order to present the trauma of the body destroyed by the bomb. And I recently heard that the American director Michael Bay, who made Armageddon, is shooting a film on the corona pandemic. So yes, I think that would happen.
Raya, I would like to conclude with a different topic, but before that, I would like to say thank you for the research you're doing, because I really have the feeling that it's also very, yeah, political work as well, and a work that might really help us in the future to deal with other traumatic experiences and to deal with it in the language of cinema, but also by reflecting it, reflecting what is going on in cinema concerning trauma and the pandemic and all the other crises that unfortunately still exist. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
So as I said, to conclude our conversation, I would like to come to a different topic. In 2014, you received the Hebrew University Rector Prize, a prize awarded to distinguished scholars for excellence in research, teaching, and contribution to university academic life. One of the things the award highlights is that good teaching is very important to you. Tell us about your classes, if you like. What distinguishes them? What constitutes high quality teaching for you?
I think the most interesting part of my work as a teacher is the daily challenge I face every day anew because of the heterogeneity of my classes. This is most conspicuous in the courses I teach on the evolution of Israeli cinema and on films of the Intifada. At the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, we have secular and Orthodox Jews. We have Israeli Jews and Israeli Palestinians, and both male and female Israeli veterans who served their compulsory service in the Israeli Defense Forces before attending university. So these classes are very heterogeneous in nature. Mm. And we all know that teaching cinema entails seriously addressing spectators' identification. And of course, it's not easy to watch these films and discuss them, especially for the Palestinian students who are a minority in the university. I decided at a very early stage to teach both Israeli and Palestinian films and to invite Palestinian directors to talk with my students. I also venture into ex-curriculum projects. For example, I organized more than once a one-day conference to which I invited Israeli and Palestinian directors who co-produce short films to meet with my classes. We screened 3 short films and opened the door for a discussion, which of course included the issue of cooperation and co-production. Since these are very sensitive subjects, especially for the Palestinian directors, I chose a series of short films on sport, and this allowed us free conversation and enabled Palestinian and Israeli Jewish students to share emotions and attitudes. I believe and hope this is the right direction for me as a teacher and for them as students to get close through the shared humanity.
Is there currently a special project in teaching that you're working on? I mean, teaching is very complicated or problematic at the moment, but is there a project you're working on?
Yes, I'm working on 2 projects which do not relate to Israeli or Palestinian cinema, but to global cinema, world cinema. Following Me Too, I began teaching a new course I entitled From Her Point of View, which deals with films of women directors. This is the first one. And the second one, I've also expanded my teaching on human rights and documentary cinema worldwide, because I think it's very important. It's important for me and it's very important for my students.
Kaya, thank you very much for this inspiring conversation and all the best for the brilliant classes you're planning and the research you give to us, to the community, and to a wider audience. To this very important topic and your political work that is the heart of your research.
Yeah, I'm in a way lucky that my hobby, my political agenda, and my profession are one.
Here is the news chapter. In the 5th episode of this podcast, I already reported about the so-called YAMHIS challenge. This is a challenge set by the International Association for Media and History, which is aimed to young researchers and is intended to help them organize their own event. In the aforementioned episode, I had the pleasure to speak to the coordinator of the challenge, Melanie Bell. She was so kind to give us an insight into the formal aspects of the award. Now the winners of the YAMHIS challenge have been announced. This year, the winners are Veronica Johnson from the National University of Ireland, Galway, and Astrid Corporal from the Kingston University of Art. Here is a short conversation I had with Astrid.
Hi, Astrid. Congratulations on winning the YAMHIS Challenge.
Thank you.
First, tell us a little about yourself. You're currently working on a PhD. What is the topic?
Yes, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here. I started my PhD in September, and it's an AHRC-funded collaborative doctoral award, which means that it's connected both to Kingston University and to the Frames of Representation Film Festival, which is based at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London. And the title of my research is Peripheral Visions, Reframing the Margins in Film and Film Festival Ecologies. And I am looking at contemporary examples of transcultural collaborative filmmaking, which I argue disrupts the anthropological structure of observational documentary and the model of passive cinema spectatorship. And it involves looking at contemporary case studies, but also historical research into different viewing contexts of early cinema, especially looking at other cultures or othered cultures. And eventually, the aim is to propose some strategies for exhibiting and sharing films in ways that are decolonizing.
Wow. And I mean, when you started in September, I think one still could say you were at the beginning. But nevertheless, when do you expect to be ready to publish your PhD thesis?
Well, it's a bit tricky because of the corona period as well. So my research is connected to the Frames of Representation Film Festival, and that has now been postponed until maybe November or maybe next year. But I am, you know, getting on with other things, and I'll be doing a international placement at the Yale Center for British Art next summer, if all goes well. And then hopefully the year after that, I will be able to finish.
So I keep my fingers crossed.
Thank you.
You're also a curator. In which curatorial field are you practicing?
So I work in the wider field of contemporary art and also education. So before I started my PhD, I worked for 4 years as curator of education partnerships at the Institute for Contemporary Arts in London. And I organized a lot of conferences, curated performances and different events related to contemporary art. And I worked with the Frames of Representation Film Festival. And before that, I co-founded an exhibition space called Almanac Projects, which is in London and Turin. And at the moment, I'm actually working on an online program for Almanac Projects on the topic of care, community, and ecology.
And in addition to your scientific writing and your work as a curator, you're also an author. You told me that your texts are mostly about art. So, yeah, give us an idea of what kind of texts you're writing when you're working as an author.
Yes, I actually just published my first poem on the platform Hoax last week. But usually I write about artworks and exhibitions and films. And I try to really sort of empathize with the piece that I'm writing about and also bring out different perspectives and maybe inspire different audiences to engage with the work by, yeah, just bringing in different elements.
And let's come back to the topic why I ask you to do this short conversation with me in this news chapter. How did you learn about the YAMHIS Challenge?
Well, I was following the journal, which is great, and I just became a member, and then I read about the challenge, and I really like the idea of a challenge, and also that it's an opportunity for young researchers. So yeah, I was really excited about it, and I'm very happy to be able to work on my projects.
I also once won the YAMHIS Challenge and was able to organize a workshop on extras in film history with the prize money, but above all, through the mentoring of two YAMHIS members, Paul Lesch and Tobias Hochschaff. With which project did you apply?
The project is called Moving Images, Institutional Bodies. And It will be a two-day symposium in the spring of next year, exploring the creative and the ethical use of moving image and film and photography as a medium to engage with contested or problematic institutional collections, histories, and archives. And specifically, it's looking at practices that are engaging with institutions connected to the discipline or the incarceration or the separation of bodies and objects from their social context. And that means looking at films often engaging with museum collections, colonial museum collections, or engaging with prisons and inmates. And I developed the event in collaboration with my PhD supervisor, Philip Bornell, who's a filmmaker and has recently been producing films with inmates and in prison contexts. And it will be part of the research center called the Visible Institute at Kingston University.
So the symposium will take place in London, right?
Yes, yes.
Who would you like to participate in the symposium? Is it meant for young researchers?
Definitely. We hope to have a mix of research presentations and filmmakers, and also to mix theoretical presentations and actually short film screenings. So it would be for a broad audience, researchers, young researchers, students, but also filmmakers, artists, and maybe also activists who are interested in the topic of contested collections or contested spaces like prisons.
Do you know already when you will publish the call for participation or the call for papers, or do you only invite people? How do you plan to find your participants?
It depends a little bit on the budget, because we're hoping to partner with a couple of other institutions. But with the IMHIST budget, we will be inviting some speakers and some artists, and then hopefully also developing perhaps a special issue of the journal for which there'll be a call for papers. But yeah, it could become bigger, but for now it will be invited participants.
Thank you very much, Astrid, and good luck. And we will hopefully read a journal issue on this very interesting topic. And yeah, I wish you a very inspiring symposium in spring, and hopefully the corona pandemic will be over then, so that you can really meet live and in person in London.
Definitely. Thank you.
This is the Dear Diary chapter. In my project, The Cinematic Face of Cities, I'm dealing with the image of so-called film cities. I would like to add a specific film scientific perspective to the existing research on images that comes especially from marketing research. This perspective understands that the image of film cities is not solely a matter of a series of actions undertaken by a city's marketing departments as a form of top-down implementation, but one that thrives on numerous interdependent networks of actors taking up the actuality of urban film history. I would like to describe the process of image formation as a discursive one. The term discourse is one that is used frequently and extensively in numerous disciplines, as well as various forms of discourse analysis. In recent weeks, I have therefore tried to address the various conceptualizations of discourse. I've been thinking about which of them are useful enough to operationalize in my work. The selection of a particular concept of discourse and its subsequent operationalization is enabled on a decision about its appropriateness in relation to the object of research, of course. The object of research is an extremely heterogeneous one. In the discursive process of image building of a film city, we're dealing with numerous actors and their varied contributions to the discourse, inclusive not only of texts on the subject of film and city, but also images on the walls of houses, streets named after filmmakers, or leisure activities that relate to film and the city in some way. An orientation solely inclined towards Foucault, a theorist whose concept of discourse is most frequently referred to in the literature, did not seem sufficient to me due to the material and non-linguistic performative elements that shape the discourse. Of the other theories of discourse, Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe's approach seemed to me to be the most suitable. Their work, Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, published in 1985, is key. They refer to Foucault, but represent a more open concept of discourse, a perspective which can certainly be criticized and has already been subject to attack, but which seems to me to be very helpful in getting a grip to the heterogeneity of the field of discursivity, in a great part due to its explicit turn to the material and non-linguistic performative elements. Laclau and Mouffe encourage me to first open myself up to everything that is there as potentially discursive. Even a stone can, but does not have to, be part of a discourse at the moment when it is brought into a meaningful relationship with other elements through an articulatory practice. Hegemony and Socialist Strategy is not an easy read. The reading was not a real pleasure, to be honest. Therefore, for those who are interested in Laclau and Mouffe, I would like to recommend the work of Georg Glaser. He is professor for cultural geography at the Institute of Geography at the Friedrich Alexander University Erlangen-Nürnberg. Glaser uses Laclau and Mouffe's perspective on discourse in his work and has published a number of papers on the operationalization of their discourse theory. His reflections help to ensure that the expanded concept of discourse is not only applied in human geography studies, but also in social and cultural science research on space, for instance, the analysis of the relation between space identity and politics, and also in film studies projects such as mine. How exactly I operationalize the discourse theory will have to wait another episode. So much for today. That was Film Studies Bling Bling. After 10 episodes, I'm allowing myself the luxury of a holiday in August. So the next episode will be released on September the 20th. As I said in the beginning, please send me your topics, news, hints on events. All are welcome. So have a beautiful August. You'll hear from me again in September.